Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on. But either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have the recent announcement that an historic peace deal will finally be reached in Colombia. But things aren't as clear-cut as they might seem. Most of you folks probably missed it because it was announced on the same day as the Brexit results. But the Western Hemisphere's longest-running military conflict is finally drawing to a close. The Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, commonly known as FARC, and the government agree to a ceasefire that they plan will lead to a final peace before September, at which time the population will vote whether or not to accept the agreement. On the surface, everything looks good and smooth, but dig a little deeper, and there are a bunch of complexities that barely anyone's talking about. The first thing is about the upcoming vote, since there's no agreement yet on what form it'll take, with FARC and the government having different approaches to this. Next up is the arrangement for some FARC members to be eligible to run for public office, which is sure to inflame a lot of right-wingers that hold a deep resentment against the leftist guerrillas. In connection with that, former President Alvaro Uribe and a slew of right-wing paramilitary forces are dead set against this deal and are totally opposed to President Juan Manuel Santos's plans to peacefully end the war that's been going on since 1964. Assuming that he's somehow able to weather the opposition and push his vision through, the next question is about the proposed peace deal's constitutionality, both in terms of whether its provisions will be legal and whether it'll take precedence over other existing legislation. And finally, last but not least, we have the so-called areas of concentration, which are isolated hamlets that FARC members will go to while preparing for civil reintegration. Oh, and all of this is contingent on FARC and right-wing paramilitaries laying down arms and abiding by the deal. Let's also not forget that the National Liberation Army, also known as the ELN, is not included in this arrangement and is currently in the stalled process of negotiating its own deal with the government. So here's what we have, guys. It looks like the war will eventually end, but the devil is in the details, just as it always is. And there is a lot that can go wrong, from the people rejecting the deal, to right-wing politicians preventing it from even getting up to a vote in the first place, to say nothing of Colombia's version of Pravi sector-like paramilitaries sabotaging the last stage of this process that took 4 long years of negotiations in Havana to even get to. Having said that, I feel moderately confident that this really is the beginning of the end for Colombia's civil conflict, although I do expect a few minor disturbances and possibly even some setbacks along the way before the final peace deal is signed. But I think that just about all the main players have a real interest in restoring national stability across the whole country, whether out of patriotism, pragmaticism, or profit-minded inclinations through the Pacific Alliance Trade Partnership. The next one up are the new non-permanent members of the UN Security Council and some of the regional issues that they'll likely lobby for. The end of last month saw a small handful of countries elected to take up temporary 2-year seats at the world's most exclusive governing body, the UNSC. While these short-term members don't hold anywhere near the importance as the 5 permanent ones do, it's expected that they'll still try to promote the global platform to promote issues that are important to them. To bring you up to speed, the countries that were brought on board are Bolivia, Ethiopia, Kazakhstan, and Sweden, with a special arrangement being reached whereby Italy and the Netherlands will each serve 1 year in the same seat, with Rome starting first. So taking stock of these countries and being familiar with their geopolitical interests, here are some of the issues that I think they'll lobby for. If you look at Bolivia, it's run by Evo Morales, the popular left-wing president. So judging by his record, we can expect him to promote environmental issues, social labor and indigenous rights, and rail against American interference anywhere in the world, especially in Latin American countries such as his own and Brazil. Moving along to Europe and starting with Sweden, this Nordic country will likely try to leverage its position in the Arctic Council and Scandinavia to advocate for more global attention to this region. But unlike Bolivia, its intentions won't be altruistic. Whether clothed in environmental rhetoric or not, Sweden's government will likely find a way to promote NATO's interest in the Arctic Ocean and possibly even in the Baltic Sea too, remembering how the non-member state basically behaves as an open proxy of the bloc, especially when it comes to phantom Russian sub-hunts. Italy and the Netherlands likely won't have much of a difference in their approaches, and they'll represent traditional Western European interests. though Rome might concentrate a bit more on the immigrant crisis in the Mediterranean, and if it does, it'll lobby for a militarized solution favorable to NATO's strategic ends, while Amsterdam, depending on if it gets a Euro-cautionary government by that time or not, might also take a stricter approach towards the issue and continue where Italy left off. As for Ethiopia, it's endeavored for its time in the sun for way too long, and with a burgeoning economy and a new Chinese-built railroad to the Red Sea in Djibouti, it's prepared to make the most of its historic global opportunity in showcasing to the world just how far it's come in the past 25 years. The same goes for Kazakhstan, and for a similar Silk Road reason, namely that its plan to bridge East Asia with Western Europe by means of Chinese-built high-speed rail infrastructure. Both of these countries, alongside Bolivia, will solidly stand behind the multipolar permanent UNSC champions of Russia and China, in helping to balance out the unipolar influence that'll be represented by Sweden, Italy, and the Netherlands. Third on the countdown is Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's four-nation tour of Africa, which will take him to Mozambique, South Africa, Tanzania, and Kenya. I've written quite a lot about Indian strategy over the past year or two, and to me, Modi's visit makes perfect sense if you understand New Delhi's strategic calculus. Back in March of last year, an important three-day conference was held in Bhubaneswar, titled Indian Ocean, Renewing the Maritime Trade and Civilizational Linkages, where national experts proposed a so-called cotton route to challenge China's New Silk Road. While scant details were released about this vision, I wrote an article for Sputnik where I forecast some of the areas that India could focus on, including the Mideast, Southeast Asia, and the east coast of Africa. It's in this last region where Modi's traveling, and he's going to these four countries not just because of their direct maritime links to India, but also because of the influential Indian diaspora that lives there. Although not large by comparative standard, the Indian community in eastern and southern Africa is mostly a legacy of the British imperial period, and they usually occupy medium to high-class positions in the commercial and financial sectors of these countries, unlike their compatriots in the Gulf that are mostly engaged with hard labor. Modi's looking for something specific in each of the countries that he's visiting, and like always, he's counting on the Indian diaspora to help him achieve it for their shared ancestral homeland. Mozambique has some of the world's largest untapped LNG deposits, and India's already invested a few billion in helping to identify and extract these resources. With India's energy consumption set to spike in the coming decades, it's important for the country to diversify its sources. South Africa, as we all know, is a fellow BRICS country, and combined with the moderately impactful Indian footprint there, both in the present and historical sense, like with Gandhi, it's a no-brainer why Modi would go there. Tanzania is a bit different of a case, because India actually holds a lot of influence there, being the country's top import and export partner, and surprisingly beating China in these respects. When it comes to Kenya, Indian imports are slightly behind China's and rank in at second place, but in both East African Community countries, Tanzania and Kenya, China is financing two Silk Road-related projects, the Standard Gauge Railway in Kenya and the Central Corridor in Tanzania, and India wants to ingratiate itself with the respective leaders of each host country in order to find a way to piggyback off of China's investment, which is actually kind of smart if you think about it, though it does seem a bit sneaky. Still, this would align with what was just recently written in one of the latest editorials at the Chinese government-run Global Times news outlet, namely that, quote, Indian strategists and the government believe that there is some geostrategic design behind the Belt and Road Initiative. Now, India has adapted opposing, delaying, and hedging measures towards different parts of the initiative, end quote. With that in mind, it sure makes you wonder what Modi's true motives might be in these four African countries, especially Kenya and Tanzania, doesn't it? Our runner-up are the three suicide bombings that took place in Saudi Arabia this week, and how they show that Daesh is truly un-Islamic and totally out of control. Words can't describe just how disgusted I am with Daesh for what it did in Saudi Arabia this week, particularly with targeting the Prophet's mosque in Medina during the last days of Ramadan. As if people didn't realize it by now, and they should have a long time ago, Daesh is not representative of the Muslim faith and is actually absolutely anathema to it in terms of the violence that it wages, especially against fellow believers. Sure, they claim to be acting on behalf of their religion due to their extremely perverted interpretation of the Quran, but the reality is that they are on the fringe and do not represent the conventional Islam that the vast majority of adherents abide by. Having gotten that out of my system, it's now time to turn to the geopolitical implications of these attacks and what they represent. Well, there's plenty of evidence tying Saudi Arabia in with the birth of Daesh, that doesn't necessarily mean that Riyadh still wields controlling influence over the group. And the latest attacks prove that its spawn has rebelled against the master and gotten totally out of control. There's no explanation, no believable thing that anyone could say to argue that Saudi Arabia would have done this to itself. That doesn't make any sense, so I won't even entertain that wacky train of thought. Instead, what I do propose is that the group is being pressed out of the Levant, and faced with what is the inevitable destruction of its caliphate, has decided to switch targets and take its original Saudi creators down with it. Let's not forget that Saudi Arabia is a national security state with very little personal freedom, so it's not that easy to carry out attacks there. But then again, with the virulent Wahhabi strand of Islam originating there and being the official sect of the kingdom, they can have any number of so-called lone wolf terrorist recruits in the country that could be under Daesh's influence and ready to carry out his bidding. Moreover, if we look at the bigger picture and not lose sight of Saudi Arabia's quagmire conflict in Yemen, its deepening economic crisis, the rumors of a soft palace coup by Defense Minister Mohammed bin Salman and the whispers of a counter-coup to oppose it, incessant discriminatory oppression against the Shiite majority in the oil-rich eastern province, and despicable working and living conditions for a growing but embittered community of South Asian laborers, it's clear that Daesh terrorism is the last problem that the kingdom needs right now, and it might just be the straw that breaks the camel's back and collapses the House of Cards. At our top spot, we've got Turkey's pivot to Russia and what it all means in the global context of the new Cold War. I think that everybody was pretty surprised by the unannounced Russian-Turkish detente, but like all things, hindsight is 20/20, and it seems so inevitable when we look back on it. Still, I'd like to offer my own commentary on all of this because I fear that the mainstream and alternative media discourse on all of this is missing out on a few critical factors. Firstly, while it's definitely true that Erdogan realized that he was cornered and had to enact a peaceful strategic breakout, no unfolding pragmatic reconciliation between Turkey and Russia could have taken place had Moscow not been interested in it as well. Let's remember that President Putin has always said that Russia's problem with Turkey wasn't with Turks, but with Erdogan's government for what they did in shooting down the anti-terrorist jet that was flying over Syria, which the Russian leader famously said was a stab in the back because he had trusted him. Like we all know, Russia enacted economic restrictions against Turkey that totally killed off its tourism industry, and amidst pre-existing political problems, also spiked domestic discontent against the government. Russia doesn't need Turkey's tourist beaches to survive, but Turkey needs Russian tourists to survive. And what Russia gets out of this whole arrangement is much, much more than just allowing its citizens to return to one of their favorite vacation destinations. Forgot amidst the dramatic events of the 8 months is the Turkish Stream Pipeline, which I call Balkan Stream, and which was indefinitely suspended after Erdogan's treachery in late November. Now, though, this multipolar megaproject will likely be restarted, and with it, Russia's Balkan policy will receive a kickstart just in time to help complement China's Balkan Silk Road high-speed rail corridor that it's constructing from Budapest to Piraeus, and which might one day even go as far north as Warsaw, Riga, and even St. Petersburg. Another thing, too, that we can't forget about is the return of militant Kurdish separatism in the Mideast, which has been co-opted by the U.S. in order to promote the geopolitical Israel of Kurdistan, or in other words, the carving up of a new pro-Western country out of territory that's already part of another state, or in this case, four states. The successful emergence of a Kurdish federalized or internally partitioned statelet in northern Syria would embolden the PKK to use it as a safe haven for broadening their attacks against the Turkish state, as well as simultaneously turning Syria into the Mideast Bosnia, a dysfunctional, identity-separated state. If we factor in the talk that Turkey and Syria might be engaging in secret third-party diplomacy with one another, and both are threatened by the rise of a pro-American Kurdistan, then Turkey's outreach to Russia is simple to understand. Ankara wants Moscow to help Damascus rein in rebellious YPG militants after the defeat of Daesh, and in exchange, Russia gets Balkan Stream back. Sounds like a good deal to me, but let's see if both sides can deliver. So alright guys, there you have it. This is this week's exciting episode of Context Countdown, and like always, I want to thank you guys for tuning in to my program. I hope that you guys will tune in again next week, and I warmly welcome you all to share my program on social media. Thanks again for tuning in. Take care and have a nice weekend. Bye.